remember the book and or movie Being There? The major character knew gardening very well, and that's really about all he knew. Chance the gardener would talk about tending to plants, and the world assumed he was speaking in brilliant metaphors about tending to life as if it were a garden. We'll give today's guest credit for a broader range of knowledge than Chance the Gardener. Karen Mazin Miller is a Zen Buddhist priest and the owner, with her family, of a Southern California house that includes a Zen garden. She's written a book called Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. Karen Miller, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I should point out that Karen is a Zen Buddhist priest and teacher at the Hazy Moon Center in Los Angeles. She leads retreats around the country and is the author of a couple of other books, including Hand Wash Cold and Mama Zen. Hand Wash Cold sounds like a somewhat similar concept, using a physical act to understand a more metaphysical kind of thing.
Well, that's actually what Zen Buddhism teaches, that we don't deal in metaphysical or philosophical concepts, but the enlightened life is your ordinary life. And so you bring that awareness and attention to what's at hand. And so it really is the laundry, and it really is the backyard.
And we are to take joy in the simple things like that, then?
Well, sure, we take joy, but we also take sorrow. We take things as they come. That's actually the outcome of your own presence and your own attending to what's at hand, is that you accept and manage and deal with it as it is.
So the paradise of the title refers to what?
Paradise. What I'm asking
because there's
people
no reference
to do is to shake loose their notions of what paradise might be, because most of us have the conventional view of paradise, which is that it's not here, it's not this, it's not now, it's some kind of mythical ideal. So what I found in the course of studying up on the history of gardens and in beginning to work in this historic garden in my backyard is that paradise wasn't at all ever intended to be something remote, something that we might arrive at one day if we're very lucky or very good. But the original word paradise comes from the old Persian, and it actually meant just an enclosed area. And it was used, the word was created to refer to grounds behind palaces for the moneyed elite that were cultivated as parks or gardens. So it really is that the modern day equivalent is your very own backyard.
Which is a tricky thing, I would think, for a lot of people to grasp, the idea that paradise is not something off in the future or beyond the curve of the earth, but potentially right very much in front of you.
Oh, yes. That's absolutely why, that's the whole point. We reject everything that's real, for the most part, in our lives in favor of an ideal or a fantasy. And that's how we can end up living life blind to our life, and missing everything that we've been offered.
So, Karen, when you and your husband went house hunting, were you looking for a garden with a house attached, or more like a house with a garden that might happen to be there?
We weren't looking for a garden at all. We were simply looking in kind of with opposing views, which is perhaps common in a couple. We had different views of what kind of a place we'd like to live. I was really a type A kind of a person, and I had always managed people and things and had my own business. I say in the book, the only thing I'd ever grown was mold on bread. So I was not at all interested in having a plot of land. I simply wanted a home in common so that we could begin our life and family together. But my husband had a different idea. He was worried that I might go crazy if I had too much time on my hands. So he had asked a realtor if she could show us places that had a little garden. And so we were both, frankly, taken aback and quite surprised when she brought us here.
So, again, this was the first home, though, that you and your husband were getting together, is that right?
Yes, we had married at midlife and lived in different places, different states, actually, had very separate lives, and some would call it, speaking of an ideal relationship, sometimes that can be an ideal relationship, but I was motivated to get together and start a family, and so eventually we reached the point where we were looking at a place that we might move in together.
You write, from the curb you'll see the gate, from the gate you'll see the path. What did you see at the curb when you pulled up to this place?
Nothing, actually. You know, it's kind of interesting. And this is literal. You know, some people will appreciate this metaphorically as the curb, you know, the distance that you stand at, the arm's length distance from which you view perhaps your life, and you see yourself at a remove, not quite engaged, you know, not really stepping into it, not embracing where you are, but in particular, at our on our street here, you could see nothing from the curb because we had a stand. We have a stand of giant bamboo that curtains the front of the property, and so you can't even see beyond. Clearly, again, you know, the treasure that you're seeking, the beauty that you're looking for, is hidden in plain sight.
Right behind the bamboo, and we'll get behind that bamboo as we go further into the book and into the garden with Karen Mazin Miller, the author of Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. Back on The Exchange with Karen, and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us on The Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Karen Mazin Miller, Zen Buddhist priest and author three times over. Her latest book is called Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. The Zen Garden is in the back of the of a home she and her husband share in Southern California, and was a delightful surprise and has provided, not metaphor, but really the process of figuring out life through gardening, and a lot of applications potentially for a lot of us here. Join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So, Karen, a bit of a giggle here in the book. The person who showed you the place said, I know it doesn't fit your parameters.
Yes, I know. She had, you know, she had no idea. We'd never met. She had no idea who I was, but she had brought me to a Zen garden when I was already a very seriously committed Zen practitioner. So she certainly got my attention. And she also got the sale. We purchased the house immediately.
No waiting whatsoever, huh?
No waiting. No, it just becomes, it was just so obvious. It was shocking, and yet it was so clear that we couldn't be anywhere else, and that everything had led to this point.
So walk us through this. We talked about pulling up to the curb, and you really couldn't see much because of the bamboo. And so once,
right, so
once...
then we walk into the gate, and this is a 100-year-old garden, and the original garden gate is now positioned right in front of, right near the curb, and we walked under this gate, and it's very decayed and decrepit and kind of leaning to one side, but it has some calligraphy on it. It's very clearly an old and authentic gate, and I immediately had goosebumps. I thought to myself, where am I? I had been born and grew up in Southern California, but I hadn't been back in decades, and I recognized the scent from the oranges overhead. There were orange trees. I recognized the smell of the dirt and the air, and I had this overwhelming sense of familiarity and that I was coming home. We walked down the path to the front door, and the realtor was saying things to us, but I couldn't hear her because I had suddenly, in an instant, switched gears and gone from the place of rejecting everything I had been shown to really receiving it. And now I was just ready to see what lay beyond the front door. We entered the house, looked through a plate glass window, and there before us was a 7,500-square-foot Japanese garden with four ponds, three bridges, two waterfalls, and a tea house. A stunning, actually, it seems impossible, an amazing picture. And I knew in that moment that this is where I would spend the rest of my life.
You talked about the reactions on previous things, previous visits. So, I mean, and how quickly you embraced this place. Were you just as quick in rejecting the previous places you'd looked at?
Well, and yes, you know how when you go house hunting, I don't know if you've done that, but
yes,
most of us have, and you see this long list of places, and you just step foot inside, and you see all kinds of scenes that, you know, I couldn't live here. I couldn't live here. This isn't me. This is wrong. And it just, it's an instantaneous and intuitive response. In fact, maybe house hunting may be, for each of us, the most purely intuitive experience that we have.
Really? I haven't even thought about it that way. You're really not thinking about the economics so much as just like, does this feel like home or not?
Yes, and you're looking, you're open to recognizing something. You feel like you know it. In some deep place, you know it. You will know it when you see it. That's actually a perfect example of a spiritual awakening or a spiritual journey. You're not motivated by what you think or what you know, but you are seeking that sense of belonging and homecoming.
Karen Mazin Miller, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. You had mentioned the fact that your ability at gardening was pretty much limited to being able to grow mold on bread. So that establishes your knowledge of gardening. Give us a little more insight into Zen at this point, because it is a term that is just thrown around so easily. When people refer to a famous basketball coach as the Zen master, I don't think they're quite serious, but you're a very efficient writer. You do give a basic idea.
It is. I mean, you can look at it very superficially or aesthetically or philosophically, and then you can relate to it as I do, which is as a classical, formal practice, spiritual practice, which relies entirely on seated meditation. And so this is a monastic form of practice that has been handed down for thousands of years, and I practice in that way. And a Zen is called the way. And what we're really talking about is practicing being able to be awake and alert and receptive to reality, your life, real life. And so we sit still and quiet to experience, to practice staying put and being alert and awake with things as they are, not needing to run away, not needing to cover up, you know, without fear. So that's the practice that actually allows you to be awake, fully functioning and aware, be real and genuine in your own life, you know, to do what needs to be done.
So not about letting your mind wander or trying to think deep thoughts, but simply being there and thinking about what's around you, being aware of what's around you.
Yeah, and actually we say we not one thought deserves a second thought. We have lots of practice thinking. It what transforms our life is when we practice letting go of our thinking, letting go of our thoughts, letting go of our feelings, so that then we can actually experience the reality of our lives. It's not so bad, I'll tell you that. Reality, usually, we can manage. It's our ruminations, you know, and our preoccupations that are so cumbersome and distracting.
It's a very humble way of looking at life and the self, and in fact, to where the self is not terribly important, I would think.
Oh, it's completely humbling. And I think that's the root of power, you know, or the root of our strength is to get over ourselves. Then we can find a life that's really purposeful because it becomes a life of service. And we do small things and little things. We take care of the small details without much credit, you know, without much noise. It's deeply fulfilling.
All right. So we have the good capsule description of Zen here then. And then, so this was described as a Zen garden. What is the story of the garden?
Well, the story, it's not quite a Zen garden, although if you put a Zen practitioner in a garden, it becomes a Zen garden. Well, the history of the garden is that it was built in 1916 by a woman who owned an estate property on this little hillside where I live in Sierra Madre, which is just a suburb of Los Angeles. And she built a series of gardens. One of them was a Japanese-style garden, which was very fashionable at the time, you know, the turn of the 20th century. All the wealthy people, the elites, wanted to a testament to how sophisticated they were. And so a lot of Japanese gardens went in, and she hired a fellow from Japan named Tokutaro Kato, and he came to this property, and he designed the garden, and he used a group of local fellows to build it, and it has stayed intact for nearly 100 years since then. At mid-century, 1949 to be exact, the property was subdivided, and you know, the suburban street that I live on really took form. It's quite ordinary, but my property here was configured around the garden to keep the garden intact. And a series of homeowners, actually private homeowners, have cultivated and kept the garden going ever since then.
And nothing really was there to say, hey, you need to keep this in perpetuity. It was just their choice.
Well, you know what it is, Jeffrey? It's that it's made of rock, and it's so large and stable, and you would have to be totally blind, ignorant, or arrogant to put something else here. It's so obvious that this is what it is. And the garden, I found, in spite of my ignorance, tells you what to do. It shows you what to do if you show up, even without any knowledge, and spend a little time here. It will become clear to you what needs to be done, and then you just do it.
Karen Mazen Miller is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is Paradise in Plain Sight: Lessons from a Zen Garden. This is the garden on the property she shares with her husband in Southern California. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back and talk a little bit more about you and how you got into Zen. I mean, this is far, far removed from the career you had before this, to put it mildly.
Yes. Well, you know, I think we all are given the equal opportunity to mess up in our lives, you know, to have a crisis, an emotional or spiritual crisis. I wasn't particularly religious. I used to say my religion was capitalism. You know, I was simply devoted to my work and to the idea of success. You might even say I was devoted to the idea of paradise, that if I worked really hard and got very good at something, that I could assemble everything that I thought would make me happy.
Paradise through money, in a sense, it sounds
money,
like.
Money, yeah, mm-hmm. Things, you know, the right house on the right street, the cars, vacations, so forth. But, of course, that's folly. Everybody finds that out, and I found that out as I was approaching 40, and I had a marriage fail, and I became disillusioned with my work. I suddenly found that I thought, for a person who thought she had everything, I had nothing. But I found a book on my shelf in my own home that was left behind by someone, and it was the Tao Te Ching. I don't know if you're familiar with that verse of the ancient Chinese verse, and I thought it was, I picked it up because it was such a small, slender book with a red spine. It drew my attention, and I just began exploring this whole other dimension of life that I had been afraid to, participate in before. And I remembered that someone had told me that the greatest living Zen master of the 20th century was in Los Angeles. I was living in Houston, Texas at the time. And I guess I was at the point where I had lost, you know, a lot of self-consciousness, and I was kind of grasping at things that might save me, and I thought nothing of flying out to Los Angeles and sitting a beginner's retreat with a Zen master in Los Angeles. I wasn't very good at it. In fact, I was an utter and spectacular failure. At it. I didn't think I could do it. I think I cried the whole time. But to meet a teacher, to meet someone who seemed to be both, you know, tender and kind, but also very strong and powerful, who was resolute, I was transformed and transfixed. I thought, I want what this guy has. I want peace.
You say you cried a lot. I mean, through frustration, through longing?
Oh, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Well, one is that it to sit in seated meditation when you've never done it before is painful, you know, and it's It drives you to the limits of what you think that you can do. You know, you keep waiting for somebody to ring the silly bell so you can stand up. And, you know, this is serious. This is hardcore stuff. During a meditation retreat, we sit or do meditation for 8 hours a day. Clearly, I was insane. But I was sane enough to take myself to a place where I could learn to live, you know, with life as it is, that I could learn how to be happy, that I could learn to survive. So it's very strong medicine, but it took hold with me, and I was hooked.
Karen May Zen Miller is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book, Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. So the teacher you're talking about is Meizumi Roshi?
Yes.
Did you try any others? Did you do any shopping around?
I did. You know, what's interesting is when you first begin a spiritual practice or first begin, I didn't even call it a spiritual practice. It was just this new thing in my life. I was a bit of a tourist. You know, most of us are non-committal or, you know, kind of ambivalent, and I practiced with other people. In fact, I sat in front of Meizumi Roshi, who was really a giant, a humble giant in Zen, and I asked him for his advice on how I should choose a teacher. Here I was sitting in front of the teacher.
Can you tell me a good teacher?
Yeah, but he was very kind and honest always, and he gave me good advice.
You write about the fear you felt before you started Zen. I mean, does one banish the other, fear and Zen?
Well, what banishes fear is wakefulness. In other words, your own presence. We say that the awakened mind, or when you become, to live in the present moment is to live without fear, because fear is contrived out of your mind, your thoughts. Fear is all imaginary. I mean, wherever you're sitting right now, Jeffrey, is there anything there in your immediate environment that's threatening to you? You know?
Just this big beam over my head.
We conjure fear out of these scenarios in our head. They're all called worst-case scenarios, you know? They're about what if and one day and what about.
Mm-hmm.
So we create fear. And so when we learn to quiet those thoughts and not ruminate on, not no longer build fear, we simply are living in the present moment in exactly the place where we are, and we find that there's nothing to be afraid of.
Let's take a question here. We have John in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Karen Meizen Miller.
Hi. Well, my question is about the yin and the yang. I don't know if that's going to tie in. I know a little bit about it, but I don't know if that ties in much to what you're talking about. But why don't you tell us a little bit about that, and then if it's kind of still popular in Asia today and how that might tie into Zen.
All right. Let's see if there's a connection. Thanks for
the
call,
John. Well, you probably know more about that than I do, but I will really just talk about, you know, in life itself in front of you, you see this whole. You see the whole. You see light and dark. You see the strength and the flexibility. You know, there is, when we think about things in our head, we think in terms of opposites. We think about male and female, or day and night, this or that. And yet they're always manifesting in real life as this whole. And these attributes, really, we all have. I mean, we're absent nothing. You know, we're lacking nothing. Metaphysically or philosophically, we can name this, and we call it the yin and the yang, or we call it light and dark, or we call it male and female, or we call it strength and flexibility. And yet, that just allows us to intellectually understand it. The point in a practice is to release that intellectual knowing and just observe the reality of life. And in observing life and observing nature, you see it all. You know, absolutely nothing is lacking. So in this book, how I present that is I talk about the sun and the moon. And that's also something that poetically and allegorically appears all the time in Zen literature. But that's what that represents. We have the light and we have the dark. And in our verses we say, within light there is darkness, and within darkness there is light. But do not look for that light. Don't try to understand. Just be that.
Much more of life, thinking, and gardening in Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden with Karen Mizen Miller. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. It's the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Karen Mizen Miller, a Buddhist, Zen Buddhist priest practicing in Southern California where she lives, where she's got a house with a great garden, which taught her a lot of the lessons that she contains in her current book, Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 around the region, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. In a previous radio interview, a host asked you if you were telling people to settle. I noticed. To just settle for the stuff around you, I guess, is the approach that the question was aimed at. If this is what Zen is about. And what was your answer? What does that mean to you, to settle?
Well, the question took me back because, you know, I didn't realize that we have such an aversion to settling. And, you know, in our minds we think that means settling for less, you know, giving up the dream, not getting what we deserve. And yet the peace, you know, and the rest, that the satisfaction that we're all chasing lies in settling, you know, being able to really be present where you are. So I think I answered, you know, I mumbled something that was forgettable. I don't know. I didn't really have my wits about me. But if I had had the grounding of, you know, my great teachers and ancestors in the tradition, I would have said yes. I'm telling people to settle.
And that's okay.
Well, absolutely. You know, that's really what we have, this hunger, this appetite for more, for more, for more. And yet what we're trying to feed is this need to be at rest, to find peace, to be contented with things as they are. It doesn't mean that they don't change. You see, they change all the time. Life is fluid and dynamic. I mean, we will never be as young as we were, Jeffrey, when we started this interview.
That's true. But we will appreciate how much more we've learned along the way, won't we?
Well, you know what? We'll appreciate our lives as they are, this moment, you know, and then the next, and the next, and the next, perfect and whole and complete, lacking nothing. You see, that's the only way to live.
Karen, I have to ask if it's easier for you to feel this way now, because at one time you were a striver. You said your religion was capitalism, no? So you were like reaching for things that were far out ahead of you, and felt like they were within your grasp, it sounds like, at a lot of times.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where as soon as you grab a hold of that ring, you find that it's got a hole in the middle of it, you know? As soon as you, in fact, even I said when we came to this house, that peculiar misery that arise just as soon as you've been given what you wanted. You know, you look at it and you say, whoa, is this it? Is this all? You know, it's not enough. It's exhausting. And I had the great good fortune to exhaust myself from that chase at midlife and then be able to, you know, fall apart. So that when and it wasn't really by choice, it was because I had no choice, that the life I constructed afterwards was a different kind of life. You know, I'd worn myself out.
You do point out some parallels in the book, and I must say your writing is good enough that you're not saying, hey, look, see the parallel I'm giving here? But, I mean, you talk about the fact that the garden was beautiful, the house was okay, needed some work. But then right after this, you're talking about your teacher, Miyazumi Roshi, and about the fact that there were some things about him that were, you went, oh, wow, I didn't realize he needed renovation too.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that's really the gift that life keeps giving to us. You know, that there's really nothing matches our expectations. no one lives up to a reputation that we might ascribe to them. We are all just the way we are. And we bring our strengths and our weaknesses. You know, we bring our, we have, there's the winter, you know, and then there's the summer. That life contains what seem to be opposites, you know, what's, it contains everything. And how can we, how do we relate to that? How can we deal with it? How can we accept not only ourselves, but other people? And the truth is, that's really what the great lesson is. It's surrendering to the way things are and accepting them. And out of that comes tremendous grace and compassion. You know, we see that all of us have pain and suffering. You know, and it, you know, to enter into this great humanity opens our hearts, you know, and opens our minds, and then we can be kind.
The you draw parallels too between the rocks in the garden and rocks in life, Karen, and say that faith is a rock, an unavoidable rock. What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're actually all living on a rock. Have you noticed? We're living on a great big rock. And when we stand up, we won't fall over. And if we take a step, we won't fly off into the upper atmosphere. You know, we actually are beings of great faith. We think we don't have it, but consider life itself. It's the array of impossibilities that we live within all the time. There's an unlimited amount of oxygen. You know, our life is sustained and supported by this very earth. You see, I have found that faith is not something that I conjure out of my imagination that's dependent upon some perfect future outcome. I have faith in the here and now, and that's faith that never leaves.
So how do you deal with the future? I mean, there are still things that need to be done in the future, expectations that you have of yourself. I don't think those have changed, although they probably have altered quite a bit. So there is something other than just the here and now, and how do you look to the future through the Zen filter?
Well, it will arrive right on schedule. I mean, I don't need to do anything, and yet the future will arrive, and when the future arrives, it's going to be called now. So what I do right now determines the next moment and the moment after that. All my power is right here. Now, if I want to take a trip at some point in the future, I'm going to get out my calendar now. I'm going to make my airline reservations now. I'm going to hire my dog sitter now. You see, everything that we're doing is now, and that's going to determine how I handle this moment will determine how the next moment goes and how the future goes. I have aspiration, Jeffrey, but I don't have ambition. In other words, I aspire to fulfill my vows. I aspire to be a better mother and a better partner, but I don't have ambition as to what that outcome is going to be. I know that all that matters is what I can do right now. And right now, I can do everything. I can be kind. I can be patient. I can be loving. I can be accepting. You know, I can be compassionate. Mainly, what that means is I can stop causing trouble. If I can just do that for 1 minute, I can guarantee you that will improve the next moment.
Let's come back to the garden and talk a bit more about that, because in a physical sense, what are some of the features of the garden?
The garden is designed following a classical motif, which is called a stroll garden. And in a stroll garden, there are elements that are put in that are metaphors for the larger earth. So in my garden, we have a mountain, which is a high point. We have a meadow, which is a low point, grassy. And we have the ocean, which are four interconnecting ponds. Most of the ground in the garden is pond. It's water, just like the earth itself is covered mostly by water. Over the water, we have three bridges. We have two waterfalls, a stream and a nearby a tea house. And all of this comprises about 7,500 square feet. It's Southern California's oldest private Japanese garden, so it's old. But the plants, of course, have been replaced, and most recently been replaced by us, because I felt that in writing this book that I needed to honor my commitment to the garden and bring it up to a state in which I could leave it behind in good faith.
And as you point out, nothing says Zen like shoveling pond scum. So there's been a fair amount of work here.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I have to skim the ponds, and I have to muck the mud out of the ponds and rake the leaves. Principally, my job is weeding. In fact, I say, you know, I still haven't learned much about gardening. I mean, I'm not an expert. I don't know the nomenclature. But I have learned that in a Zen garden, what matters is not what you put in, but what you take out. And it's always obvious what there is to take out, overgrowth and weeds and leaves. So I do that kind of dirty work. It's so fulfilling, to tell you the truth. It makes the place beautiful.
And there's obviously been some solid learning along the way as well. I mean, I was surprised. You kind of blew my mind just by talking about how many types of bamboo there are.
Yeah, thousands. Yeah. Well, you learn that real quick when you have bamboo on your property, because some bamboo is a running kind and it's very invasive and destructive. And right away, you have to go to school on it in order to figure out how you can live with it.
And there obviously is a huge parallel here. You got trees around the garden. You've got the Buddha and the original tree. And so tell us that story, please.
Well, the tree, the story of Buddha is that Buddha sat beneath a tree to end his long quest for the answers to the meaning of life. He sat beneath a tree called the Bodhi tree. And he resolved that he would not get up until he had penetrated the truth. He sat a very long time, and then one morning he looked up and saw the morning star on the horizon, Venus, before the dawn. And he spoke his words of enlightenment, which were that I, the great earth, and all beings simultaneously attain the way. So from there on, people noticed that he had a changed demeanor. His face seemed illuminated. He seemed at peace and with tremendous joy, and his friends called him Buddha, which means awake. So my question for people is, how many trees have you passed by today, lost in a daydream, you know, wandering? Trees serve really as guideposts for us, you know, to wake up and see your life, appreciate your life.
One of the things I notice in differences between adults and kids is that kids, and it's not just because they're shorter, tend to notice things on the ground a bit more. They see the bugs, they see the flowers, they see the things that we as adults tend to cruise right past. Has your embrace and your practice of Zen taken you to a more childlike state where you're more delighted by simple things?
Absolutely. Yeah, if you will simply see the ground beneath your feet. It doesn't have to be sacred or hallowed special ground, but right where you are is magic. I mean, wonder. Yes, so the aim of, you know, my lifetime of practice is to return to that state of original wonder that we can assume is in the mind of a child, the experience of a child. And so we start where we are. On the ground beneath our feet, and we, as our practice matures and our perspective widens, we see that it's all ground beneath our feet.
There's quite a riff in oranges on oranges in the book. What's the significance in your life?
Oh, my grandfather grew oranges here near Los Angeles, and so I grew up spending a lot of time in an orange orchard. And he taught me how to peel an orange, for instance, and how to really savor a very ripe, fresh fruit from the tree. And then later on in life, I realized that those oranges, because they reminded me of my family story, if I could peel off the outer rind, you know, and the bitter pith, that inside that orange is that sweet, fresh flavor. And for me, the allegory is that within that, if I can peel off my resentment about the past, you know, and all of my pain, perhaps, about my family life and my parenting and so forth, that I can find the forgiveness within to restore the rifts that we all have, you know, between us.
Karen, we have to go pretty soon. I wanted to ask as a final question, you talked about the gate looking a little beat up after 100 years, whether you've done anything to fix that up. I just wonder how
I have resisted fixing up the gate. At some point, I think I might, but, you know, I think it's so much more powerful if we walk through a gate that makes us feel uncomfortable, that isn't really picture perfect, that is old, you know, and maybe, you know, pockmarked. That's the gate that we have to walk through. It's unexpected. Then it becomes an act of real courage, you know, to move beyond that gate.
And again, from the curb you see the gate, from the gate you see the path. And it's more than metaphor, it's reality. Paradise in Plain Sight, Lessons from a Zen Garden. Karen Mizen Miller, its author, our guest. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You bet. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk to folks about the swim guide, which gives you a chance to look at swim conditions in some of the region's watering holes. At 8:30, we'll talk about the reaction from Planned Parenthood Associates of Oregon to the Hobby Lobby decision from the Supreme Court. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of The Reckoning about financial accountability and the rise and fall of nations. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.